Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Alex Morris wrote an article in Rolling Stone called Michael Fanone is not your fucking hero. I think that captured me about as poignantly as possible. I finished the article with Alex and she was like, so what do you want to do for the photo? And I was like, well, I'll tell you what I don't want to do. I'm not going to the Capitol. I'm not putting on a fucking uniform. I'm staring off distantly into with like an American flag behind me and all this other shit. And I was like, I tell you what, I want to bring my dog, a cooler beer, and a lawn chair. And I want to sit on the west front of the Capitol and drink beer, and you guys can take pictures of it. So I had to call Nancy Pelosi, who was a speaker at the time, right, to get permission for us.
Get permission.
So she's like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, oh, ma'am, we're just going to take some pictures. And she's like, okay. Nothing crazy, right? And then later on that day, she calls me back. She's like, Michael, were you drinking beer on the west front of the Capitol?
Hey, folks, my guest today on the Michael Steele podcast is none other than Michael Fanone. He spent 2 decades with the Metropolitan Police Department here in D.C., where I grew up. On January 6th, however, 2021, he responded to the Capitol attack on his own. What happened that day changed the course of his life. Since then, he's become a vocal critic of how the events of January 6th have been downplayed by politicians, law enforcement, and the media. Once a Trump supporter, he's been open about how the experience shifted his views. Michael is the author of Hold the Line, The Insurrection and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul. It's a candid account of that day and what it means for the future of American democracy. We get into that, but we get into so much more. Peel back the curtain on this young man who has had a very life-changing experience as a result of January 6th. We're going to get into it and talk about it right here on the Michael Steele podcast, coming up right after this.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm excited, as always, when I see Michael Fanone in the room, and I'm glad he's here with us back for another conversation. And Michael, you doing well, brother? You looking good. Have a good Easter and all that good stuff?
Yeah, man, just, you know, time with the family. Took my kids to the O's game on Sunday, which, you know, was bittersweet. The weather was beautiful. Yeah. The kids had a blast. But the score was atrocious. So
yeah,
I love my O's, but man, they gotta work out the bullpen thing.
It, you know, it's crazy. Before we get into stuff that's in some sense not as important, but is, I guess, because it affects our democracy. You know, sports is one of those things that it crosses so many lines, which is why all the crazy stuff that Trump and his folks were doing on trying to, you know, take out, you know, race and act like it's not a part of any storyline. It is a bit, has been a big storyline in sports, but what it says is how galvanizing it is, and whether or not you are a Republican, a Democrat, a conservative, progressive, whatever the label you want to slap on yourself. When you look at your sports team, like you just said, and they don't do shit about their bench in the offseason, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what your politics are.
Absolutely. No, it's funny, too, because like I've had a lot of bad experiences out in public, unpleasant, but never, ever at a sports event, which is great.
Yeah. Right. That's the way it is. So let's get into some of that a little bit. You know, the one thing I have from the very beginning, and I've said this both privately and publicly about you, I was just struck about the commanding presence you have. I could see, as a law enforcement official back in the day for DC, that your brand was one of an officer who took his job seriously, an officer who appreciated the responsibility that the citizens bestowed, and the responsibility of actually carrying out that public service. And it is something that I think was not appreciated a lot by the public at the time of the January 6th insurrection, and even since, that what it takes to be a man or woman in uniform, both military, police, et cetera. And I've always found that about you, not blowing smoke and all of that. It's just, you know, I get a vibe about people. I just do. It can be a blessing or a curse sometimes. And I've made some bad misjudgments, Reince Priebus, along the way. But you know, you just strike me and struck me as someone who did what he had to do on that day, continues to do that, even though you're not in uniform anymore, in a way that I think the public respects you. And to the point about you getting shit from folks when you're out in public, that's because they know what you stand for and they're afraid of that. And so they want to attack and try to tear it down and demean it. But I think a lot of people see otherwise. How do you carry that weight? Now that I put all that on your shoulder, but how do you carry that weight, man? Because it's hard. I mean, I think a lot of people don't appreciate what that means. Politicians are one thing. We're all into the titles and the bullshit of sitting around trying to do legislation or be a chief executive. But to be on the streets every day in a way that police officers are, says something about the men in blue and the women in blue.
Yeah. I mean, my experience now, like I draw a lot from my experience as a police officer. I tell people all the time, you know, I get called names out in public and whatnot. Well, it ain't the first time that I've experienced that. I was a cop.
Exactly.
Right.
You pull someone over and they're like, "Bitch, why you pull me over?"
Exactly. So, you know, there's that. And then, you know, having to keep your composure, because obviously, like, you know, that, you know, a lot of these interactions, the point of it is to bait you into doing something. And
right.
As a police officer, you have to maintain your composure. And I did, I think, for the most part, throughout my career. I think that having been a cop, especially a cop in D.C., working narcotics for 20 years, uniquely prepared me for, this experience in post January 6th and the interactions with Republican lawmakers who were trying to downplay, demean, or just outright deny what my experience was, and not feeling as though I, you know, needed to be polite.
Right.
And feeling that, I had every right to tell them exactly how I felt, tell them my experience, but also to tell them what I thought about them. Mm-hmm. And I think that, Americans need to stop being afraid of these people. They're just people.
Yes. They're just that. Yes. Yes.
I think we're starting to see that the American people are, you know, they're angry, they're outraged, and they're expressing that in a way that I've certainly never seen in my lifetime, or at least since I've been paying attention to American politics, which is not that long or a period of time. But I just wish that some lawmakers could draw from that. And, you know, see our elected leaders express the same feelings. Because, I mean, listen, like, I don't know if maybe Chuck Schumer is not capable of outrage and anger. Maybe some of our elected leaders have spent way too much time in office and are no longer in touch with the American people, and let alone their constituents. And so they're just incapable of reading this moment and acting appropriately. But, you know, you need to step aside. I mean, you see a lot of lawmakers, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but you see people like Jasmine Crockett. And I think that, like, I don't really know what her politics are, but I know she cares about democracy. And I know that she's capable of expressing anger and outrage. And so I'm all for it. And I think that it probably has a lot to do with the fact that she's experienced all of this before she came to Congress, and she's still in touch with her constituents and the feelings that Americans have about MAGA and about this president and this administration, if you're on the opposing side.
Yeah, that you put your finger on, I think, a very important pulse that's starting to emerge across the country. We've seen it in the town halls. We see it now on the 50 plus 50 plus one, which is 50 protests, 50 states, one message, one movement. And it is that sense of that frustration and concern sort of put together in a way that Jasmine Crockett expressed so well when she confronts it in the hearings, when Marjorie Taylor Greene is showing her ass, as my mama would like to say, and you just need to, you know, put her back, push her back and say, you know, you're being ignorant right now, you're wrong, and these are the facts, this is the rule of law, this is the situation. I think more and more people are appreciating that. And I love the top line of what you said, because it is so damn true. They're just people. They don't have some magical power. There's no fairy dust that they spread. Project 2025 was a massive document that individuals who we've clearly identified sat down in a room over a period of time and wrote. Right. It wasn't handed to them, you know, by the fingertip of God in concrete. Right. What it wasn't. So all that shit, we can confront it for what it is. Donald Trump puts his pants on the same way you and I do, although probably with more difficulty. And the reality of it is, he's just a man too. And one thing that I will say that Donald Trump has done is, among a lot of other things, but in this respect, it's important. He's exposed and sort of taken down the veneer that we as a citizenry has put up around the White House, around the president, which allowed us to have a blind eye to the shenanigans of John F. Kennedy, to ignore or sort of try to explain away the behavior of a Richard Nixon. The reality is now that these are men, and possibly one day a woman should be, one day a woman, who are just human beings that we have put in these positions. And so the power ultimately rests with what we decide and what we do. As our founders made it very clear, we, the people, are the government. And so we no longer have to pretend that the emperor has no clothes on. He doesn't. He's now been fully exposed for what he is and what they're doing. And so I really appreciate the way you put that, because it is something, as a police officer, you would see every day when you pulled over someone with a title. All right. you address them the same way you would address anyone without a title. And if they fall within the criminal justice system a certain way, they will be dealt with the way anybody else would be dealt with. And that is an important lesson from the 34 convictions that Donald Trump now holds as a convicted felon.
Right.
He is no different than any other convicted felon in the country, except he happens to be president because we put his ass there, right? We did that. And so we now suffer the consequences of putting a convicted felon in charge. It would be like if you ran a Fortune 500 company and you put someone who was convicted on 34 counts of embezzlement and fraud and theft in charge of your company. You're going to get what you're going to get.
Right. Yeah. Right? Here we are getting.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Yep. How do you, you know, it's funny. There was a piece that was out earlier this year that by Alex Morris of Rolling Stone, who noted the headline was Michael Fanone has a lot to say about the January 6th pardons, including his own. And it says, it goes on and it talks about how you didn't ask for a pardon. You don't want a pardon. Talk a little bit about why you feel that way, why you felt that way at the time. And what do you think is happening? What does it mean when these things started coming out that, you know, Trump was looking to pardon all these people and do all this stuff? Talk a little bit about your thoughts there.
Well, first, like with regards to the pardon for me, I mean, I'm a high school dropout, but I'm not a legal scholar.
Right.
I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I do know the legal system from a layman's perspective or a police officer's perspective. And I know that our justice system is based on precedent. And I know that there's no precedent for giving a preemptive pardon. And so, you know, while I understand why President Biden provided me and some others with those pardons, because he felt we may be, you know, targeted by the Trump administration, though we had done nothing wrong, I knew that what I needed to be protected from was the endless litigation that would be that would go along with, you know, the investigations, and a pardon does not prevent any of that from happening. You know, the Trump administration, if they want to, can try to trump up some charges, no pun intended, and come after me. And then it's up to me to first invoke the pardon.
Right.
Then, you know, we're probably going to end up going to the Supreme Court as to whether or not those pardons are legitimate. Meanwhile, I've gone broke like 1,000 times over trying to defend myself because I don't have, you know, significant means. I'm just a regular guy. So I guess it was kind of two part. One, I didn't want one for the optics of it. But two, I didn't want one because I don't think it's going to make a shit of a difference anyways. That was that. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's an important piece, because when you look at the contrast between what Biden was offering and proposing in terms of the pardons that he was putting on the table for those related to January 6th versus what Trump had done when he came in shortly after that period, after Biden made those offers. Really offers up a contrast, but the result is the same, in the sense that, as we see with some of the Trump pardons, there are questions about them and whether or not they'll be, you know, litigated down the road remains to be seen. You know for sure the Biden pardons would have been. The Trump people would have come in and immediately, to your point, tried to do an end run to upend that and really question Biden's ability to use and employ a pardon power, while at the same time Trump was doing exactly that for people he liked, and whether or not the system could actually make the distinction between the two was a little bit problematic. But it does raise the broader question, I think, of how our government now sees itself functioning in this somewhat bifurcated way when a Democrat is in charge versus when a Republican is in charge. And like you said, you know, you're just an everyday guy, and you know, you pay your taxes, you're raising your kids, you're trying to keep the wife from being too mad at you on any given day. You know, you're doing these things that people do every day of their lives. And yet we're living in this time where we're asked. One of the benefits, I think, of being, which is something I think you appreciate, of being a police officer is that you didn't have to, right? The only side you were on was the side of the Constitution and the oath you swore to protect and defend it and the citizens you served. It's how do your fellow officers now, some 4 years, where 2020, well, yeah, 5 years later, feel about and perceive this system, particularly those who are still serving in it on the Capitol Hill or in DC police? What are you hearing from them?
I mean, within the DC Police Department, you know, I think there's a sense of, or at least there was a sense of disbelief that, number one, this could happen. That is like thousands of Americans attacking the Capitol. Right. And it would be so quickly forgotten. I mean, listen, like I get a lot of attention because I've been very outspoken. Those officers, the ones that continued to do the job, the ones that showed up for work on January 7th, while I was in the hospital, they didn't receive the accolades or the praise or, you know, all of the things that like myself and Harry Dunn and Sergeant Gunnell and even Danny Hodges received.
So right.
For them, just like it was life continued. And then they experienced, you know, all the horrible things that I experienced without any of the adulation. You know, they saw Republican lawmakers downplay and, you know, deny what happened that day. And they've seen Republican officials that have now been appointed by the president or, you know, people who've been elected on the idea that they think that, you know, the people that assaulted cops were patriots, the president included in that, and that the police officers that day were the aggressors and that they were somehow the enemy. And so I think within the DC police and Capitol police, these guys are just disillusioned.
Yeah.
And kind of just like, well, fuck it. Mm-hmm. What's I think adds insult to injury is that the greater law enforcement community, that is like every agency that essentially didn't respond to the Capitol that day and doesn't know the realities of January 6th, has essentially sided with Trump.
Right.
And, you know, you see that in like the National Fraternal Order of Police,
yep.
President Pat Yost endorsing Donald Trump. I mean, just the idea of the largest law enforcement union in America endorsing a man who clearly, in front of all of our eyes, incited his followers to attack police officers at the Capitol on January 6th. And mm-hmm. then pardoned 500 plus individuals who were yep. charged with assaulting cops and either were found guilty at trial or pled guilty before trial. The six individuals that assaulted me that were charged all pled guilty. No one went to trial and they're all free. Some yeah. of them were sentenced, you know, upwards of 12 years in some pretty vile and vicious assaults, and Trump just made it all go away. And so,
the disgust from that a lot of us felt is palpable. I thought though, you wrote a piece in your Substack on the 18th of this month, and I highly recommend folks to read what Michael wrote, which was an appeal to American law enforcement officers, an open letter to them. And you say in part, you, the American law enforcement officer, have been placed in an incredibly difficult situation. One where you must choose between obeying the immoral and often illegal orders given to you by your president, the attorney general, your state and federal prosecutors, and even those that lead your respective agencies. Orders that violate our Constitution, which we all took an oath to uphold against enemies, both foreign and domestic. Now choosing to capitulate and follow these orders may bring you both promotion and adulation, and choosing not to follow such orders could bring disciplinary action against you, termination from employment, or even criminal prosecution. That said, you have the benefit of history and the lessons it has taught humanity. This lawless and immoral administration will be defeated. And when it is, you will have to answer this simple yet profound question. Which side were you on? Damn. You can't get any plainer than that.
Yeah, no, I mean, earlier in the piece, I talked about two moments in my career, which, you know, had pretty much all but gone forgotten until after January 6th, because, you know, I was a cop, a DC cop for 20 years. I don't think I ever had a conversation outside of a classroom environment in which I thought about or talked about my role in protecting our Constitution and ensuring that Americans had a right to everything that's afforded under that document. I mean, I wasn't violating the Constitution.
Right.
I certainly wasn't thinking of myself as someone who was responsible for, you know, for making sure that, that every American, you know, had their, you know, enjoyed those rights.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I guess like the point of that was that I went to these seminars in which we, you know, one of them was at the Holocaust Museum, and we talked about German police and their role in, you know, arresting Jews for the simple fact of being Jews, and also their involvement in seizing property from these individuals and, you know, redistributing it amongst the Nazi party, and how immoral that was and how outrageous that was. And I remember being outraged myself and thinking, like, why the hell am I here? This would never happen in America. I would never get involved in anything like this. And the second one was a little bit more difficult, I think, for me to dismiss. But I went to the National Museum of African American History in D.C., and I remember sitting through a lecture and learning about how, you know, law enforcement's role in, you know, capturing runaway slaves and law enforcement's role enforcing Jim Crow, which I think, you know, we should all agree were immoral, unethical, and, you know, it was abomination.
Well, it's the genesis of the creation of police forces in the country was to be about the business of going out and capturing slaves and keeping them in check. So you're right.
So, like, I mean, I unfortunately, when I started coming to these, you know, realizations, I had already, you know, I was no longer a cop. But at first, I started thinking about like how valuable a lesson that would be when, you know, cops that police communities of color, especially white cops like myself, who are trying to figure out why there's all this fucking resentment and anger that I feel is undeserved. Well, if you go back, not even 100 years, go back 50 years, and you see why these communities have such disdain for fucking for law enforcement officers. And so that, you know, it's like, listen, at the end of the day, we've got to do our jobs. But that should be in your mind when you're doing your job, because it's going to make you a better police officer. But then, you know, fast forward to today, and looking at, you know, these videos of ICE agents, you know, wearing masks, approaching individuals. You know, listen, the Constitution, if you're a police officer and you're watching this, the Constitution applies to everyone that's in the United States, not just American citizens. Every single human being that is inside of our borders is entitled to the rights provided by the Constitution, one of those being due process. And watching these agents violate individuals' due process simply because Donald Trump views it as inconvenient and just wants to fulfill his promise to his constituents in getting rid of all of these people as quickly as humanly possible. And, you know, I would hope that they would think about this, you know, just from a human perspective and like, what if this was your relative or your mother or your father or your sister?
Right.
And then also being able to see it for what it is.
Yeah.
Goddamn litmus test. Donald Trump and MAGA are targeting communities that they feel that the average American cannot relate to, can't empathize with, and they're violating their rights.
Yeah.
So who's to say that eventually that doesn't, I mean, he's already talking about sending Americans to a prison, you know, in a foreign country.
Yep.
Well, you know, I think most Americans, at least the ones that I talk to, they're like, well, fucking so what? We save a couple bucks sending American, you know, these criminals. Well, what happens when the criminal is just somebody who has an opposing viewpoint from Donald?
There you go.
When, you know, what happens when the criminal is a police officer who refuses to obey an unlawful order from their superiors?
And
they're removed from the country, sent to some place where no one can communicate with them. They can't get the benefit of legal counsel. I mean, shit, we can't even get, or we finally got a senator who was able to go in there and you know, see this gentleman in the prison system. It's just, people just need to care more, empathize more, understand the, you know, or at least have some compassion for their neighbors and their experience, which may be dramatically different from them.
Yeah. And that's so, so especially true given the fact that, as you noted at the very beginning, that our Constitution protects all of us, regardless of our status. And as I've said repeatedly with respect to Kilmar Abrego Garcia, it doesn't matter if he is an MS-13 kingpin or if he's Mother Teresa. In either situation, when he's brought into our criminal justice system, due process attaches. The Constitution is there to protect him. And we need to make sure as citizens that we stand with that ideal, because to your very point, when we stop caring about what happens to Abrego Garcia, we've stopped caring about what happens to ourselves, because he has the same rights that we have, regardless of how he got here, legally, illegally, regardless of whether he has good papers or bad papers, regardless of his behavior. And none of us are condoning behavior. This is not about behavior. This is about process and rights that attach to you when our criminal justice system says, habeas corpus, we have the body. And when we have the body, those rights attach. We're going to take a quick break. We're having a quick conversation, good conversation with my man, Michael Fanone. More with Michael right here on the Michael Steele podcast after this.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Politics, especially these days, as you're probably well aware, is a tough subject to tackle. It can feel hard to wrap your head around, plain incomprehensible, or just too much. Too often, it feels like a whirlwind of information. And that's why the NPR Politics Podcast is where you should go to begin to decode what goes down in Washington and what every decision out there might mean for you and your family. First impressions are always important. All this week, the NPR Politics Podcast is unpacking the first 100 days of Trump's presidency. They're tackling what's been done, what's to come, and what might change. And as always, what it means for you. Every episode makes it easy for you to understand what's going on, from the complete restructuring of the federal government to immigration policy, tariffs, and trade. These 100 days have been monumental. Which Trump's promises is Trump actually going to keep? Will his executive orders and spur-of-the-moment decision-making change the U.S. and your life in the long term? Every day, the NPR Politics Podcast will focus on one thing and boil it down to 15 minutes or less. Think of it as your political multivitamin. Now, I was really fascinated by how hosts Tamara Keith and Franco Ordonez and Domenico Montanaro broke down how Project 2025 influenced Trump's first 100 days. Politics might move fast, but you can count on the NPR Politics Podcast to declutter it all just for you. Listen now to their NPR Politics Podcast, only from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We have Michael Fanone, 2 decades with the Metropolitan Police Department here in Washington, D.C., my hometown where I grew up in Petworth. What precinct were you in, Michael, when you were a D.C. cop?
I worked out of the 1st District my entire career. First.
Okay.
Started off over on School Street, which I don't even think exists anymore.
No.
And then we moved over to M Street, 101 M Street, the old elementary schoolhouse that they turned into the police station. So my whole career.
Awesome. D.C., but where were you born and raised?
I was born in D.C. I was born at Greater Southeast Hospital.
Really?
I grew up in Northern Virginia.
Okay. Yep. D.C. boy. Yeah, I was born at Andrews Air Force Base and grew up in Petworth. And it just, you know, D.C. is my home. And so very happy for the Commanders and the Nats and you know, a little respectability. We've been in the desert for a while in our sports, and going back to our sports conversation.
So I grew up an O's fan, so I never made that transition.
Well, yes, that's right. Yeah.
I was a Commanders fan before they became the Commanders.
Right.
And Dan Schneider just destroyed my ability to watch. And so as soon as the Ravens came, to Baltimore, I jumped on the Ravens bandwagon, and I'm not ever going to get off.
No, I love the Ravens. So I remember
when Lamar Jackson's there. The guy's the greatest quarterback that ever lived.
Who's that?
Lamar Jackson.
Oh, Lamar. Yeah, Lamar. It's just phenomenal. And I think we got a Lamar protege in the Commanders in Jalen. But we'll see how that plays out. But the reality is, I remember when the Colts left Baltimore. And what a shock that was to the system. And I also remember when the Senators left Washington, because that was my team growing up. My daddy used to take me to Griffin Stadium right there on Georgia Avenue across from what is now Howard University. Used to have the old bakery, the Wonder Bread Bakery. Remember that?
Yep.
Back in the day. And man, just being able to see those games. I still have the fly ball from one of the Senators that that hit that ball, and my dad, it hit this woman's shoulder behind me and bounced into my dad's hands. And I was like, yes. So thank you, lady with the sore shoulder. But yeah, man, it's amazing how, you look at a city like Washington, you look at this community, how much has changed the struggle it's had for its own rights as citizens living and growing up in the city. And it says so much about, in many respects, it's a microcosm for the country and what the country's going through and the limitations that, you know, these folks that are now in charge want to put on the rights we have as citizens. We were talking about before we went to break, you know, the impact of, you know, someone like what's happening to someone like Abrego Garcia and others who are being swept up by individuals, pushed into vans and taken away to spots unknown, never to be heard from. I was talking about earlier today in another setting about a young woman who's a scientist who's actually been able to manipulate research in getting us a step closer to securing a cure for certain forms of cancer. Well, she's from Russia, and she was coming back to the country leaving the country and had mistakenly had some frog embryos that she uses in her research on her person, and has been detained now two months because of that. Talking to an ICE official, he said, oh, well, the normal process before Trump was if that had happened, they would have seized the material, right? Turned it over to the government. It's the government property because she works at a lab that is supported by the federal government. And she would have been given a $500 fine for carrying this material. And that would have been it. Now, because of who she is, her nationality, Russia, and there's some thinking that the Russians are been made aware of this and they want her back. That's why they're holding her for 2 months. They may deport her back to Russia, a place that she escaped to come here to do research because she couldn't do it there and all the other restrictions. This is what our government is planning to do now and is doing. And so it really raises some concerns, which I think are unique from your perspective as a former law enforcement officer, which is why your appeal to your fellow officers still in service is so important as a reminder of what is at stake here and what we should be valuing and what we should be concerned about. When you're looking at, and you touched on this, what's happening with the massive deportation efforts and the role that apparently this administration wants the law enforcement to play in that process. Is that something if there's any resistance to those, to unlawful orders or, and that could be a nebulous thing, I guess, for some officers, you know, trying to figure out what is an unlawful order or what isn't. Where does that pressure come from? Does it come from the leadership inside the police force, or is it something that comes from the rank and file to the leadership saying, we're time out, we're not doing that?
Yeah, no, in my experience, it was always, you know, there was a result that was demanded by politicians and that, you know, those demands were put upon, you know, the executive level leadership within the department. And then the executives within the department sent out their directives and demanded results from, you know, from their lieutenants on down to, you know, to the officers themselves.
Right.
And I think that, you know, law enforcement is a paramilitary organization. And I like to say that, you know, they invoke that when they want to fuck you. But
so true.
Any other time, it's like a free for all.
This is why I love Michael Fanone, folks.
But
he keeps it real.
But, you know, I just think that, you know, the point of the piece was to get officers thinking about these things and their role in them. And then also, you know, I want to be realistic, like disobeying orders, whether they're illegal or not. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, these are Trump's police departments.
You know, these are Pam Bondi's agencies, Cash Patel's agencies. You're not going to find relief, you know, inside of the agency. Mm-hmm. And most likely you're going to end up being, you know, disciplined or potentially fired or even worse, criminally prosecuted. But recognizing the fact that, you know, disobeying these illegal and immoral orders is you're fulfilling your oath to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And there's a vast, vast network of people out here outside of your agencies from whom you can turn to and will defend you literally to the bitter end. It's something that I've experienced, and I think more and more Americans are starting to see that there is a community outside of these government agencies that's willing to go to bat for them.
You know, it's interesting because when I read your piece and when I listen to you now, and I think I have a good sense of your vibe when it comes to how you're choosing to engage in politics or to deal with political environments that you run into. I noted in preparing for our conversation that you had a very interesting perspective on politics because in the book you wrote, and I'm going to pull it up here, until recently, I follow politics like the Olympics. I paid close attention every 4 years. And that in so many ways sort of reflects everybody out there. You know, when I'm called to, oh, there's an election. Oh, OK, again. All right. And, you know, everybody kind of sort of sleepily and groggily kind of moves through the process. January 6th clearly changed a lot of that. And for individuals like yourself who are more deeply involved and affected by it, both physically as well as mentally, it creates a different look at the process of politics and the engagement of politics and the influence of politics on our system. How do you see it now? I mean, not so much... you know, maybe running for office, I guess, but that doesn't strike me as your vibe. It doesn't, at least right now, I don't get that. Harry Dunn, I could see. That made a lot of sense to me.
I think there's too many rules when it comes to running for office, and I'm not much of a rule follower.
Yeah. Trust me, Michael. I'm not either, so you can live from my experience, man.
I got 65 pages in my disciplinary history in the police department to attest to the fact that I was not a rule follower. I'll tell you, the vast majority of those were for insubordination.
Well, look, Michael, they fired my ass at the RNC because I was like, no, we're not done. We're doing this.
I mean, I'll tell you what, like, I don't know the first thing about how to run for office. Right. Like, I don't even know what form to fill out. Right. But would I run? I would do it, but it would be only while Donald Trump is president.
Yeah.
Like, I only want to be in office while Donald Trump is president. I'll tell you what. Nothing would get through the House because they would spend so much time censuring me. They wouldn't get the fucking one MAGA bill passed.
I love
that. That would be how I fight back against. Right.
He would every 2 minutes, I have a speech. Right. Michael will be on the floor yet again for his 2 minutes. Well, you know, but what that's why I said I just don't see that as part of your future. But what I do see and what I do recognize, what I think is actually more valuable than physically filling out the forms and running for office and being a member of XYZ is your voice in things that you do, and the Substack is a good example of that. I think people are curious and want to hear from you, given your experience and what and how you talk about that experience and how you manifest your anger and your frustration at what happened and what is happening, I think is a really good reflection of a lot of people out here who aren't going to run for office, who aren't going to be the senator or the congressman or the county executive, but are no less interested in making sure that whoever is in those jobs do the damn job and do it in a way in which they're mindful at every turn that they're real people who are affected by their policy decisions, that are affected by their political shenanigans, that are affected by their, you know, desire to recreate government in their own image. And that is, I think, in many respects, more valuable right now than actually holding the job.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember vividly, I did my first TV interview on CNN on the Don Lemon show. Mm-hmm. And before the interview, you just told me, like, listen, you know, just be honest, you know, be honest. And I really did take that to heart. And like, I try to talk about things using my own like personal experiences, and they're not mm-hmm. always, they don't always reflect well on me. I mean, I remember engaging, you know, trying to engage with Trump supporters, especially pre, you know, this most recent election, and mm-hmm. saying, like, listen, you know, I understand how you got here. Like, you know, I was somebody who prior to, I would say, the second half of the Obama administration, I never really felt like national politics touched me on a personal level. Like, there just wasn't, you know, it's like every administration, the pendulum, you know, kind of moved a little bit this way and a little bit that way and a little bit. And it's, but for the most part, you know, it was, I never felt like, I never made enough money to invest in the stock market. So I don't know what the hell, you know, that's all about. And, so it just, I don't know, it just never affected me. And then for the first time, the second half of the Obama administration, and we started to see all of these, protests arising from, you know, polarizing incidents involving communities of color and police mm-hmm. departments. Mm-hmm. And listen, like, I'm the first person to tell you that law enforcement is not above reform or reproach. Both are, you know, necessary. That being said, I saw a lot of politicians jumping on this, you know, hate the police bandwagon to mm-hmm. fund the police. And I started to see how communities that I was policing were responding to that. And all of a sudden, there was no longer any respect whatsoever for uniform law enforcement. You know, the amount of incidents in which individuals fought back against the cops that were trying to arrest them, you know, doubled, tripled. And listen, I watched it play out in real time. And I remember, you know, I was a plainclothes guy. I didn't wear a uniform, but I would go out and I'd sit in, you know, Cava on M Street. Mm-hmm. And watch other cops come in uniform and see the way that people treated them. I'd drive past a traffic stop where, you know, somebody was screaming or yelling, or there were people coming around, you know, that weren't involved in the traffic stop at all. And they were yelling at these cops.
And everybody got their camera thinking they're going to.
Exactly. And, you know, it's like, if you want to create an environment where police officers don't feel like it's us against them, that is not the way to go about doing it. Because I can tell you right now that police officers most certainly felt like it was an us against them scenario. And, you know, I fell into that pitfall. I started mm-hmm. to see things only through, you know, my own perspective. Mm-hmm. And how they affected me. And quite frankly, I didn't give a shit about anyone else in this country. I just cared about me as a cop and my other cop brothers and sisters. Right. And so,
I saw one party as hating the police, and I saw another party as at least pretending to love the police.
Right. So
that, you know, that there was a natural progression to vote for, you know, vote in your own best, you know, self-interest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, then obviously, you know, I've come to regret that decision, but more than regret the decision on its face, come to understand how I came to that decision and all the smaller decisions that I made along the way that were wrong.
Yeah.
And hoping that other people can, you know, learn from those mistakes and, you know, and then we could get back to, it's really hard for me to talk about empathy and compassion these days, especially after, you know, I've had people throw shit on my mother and, you know,
yep.
Everything yep. else I'm sure you've experienced as well, yep. that comes along being a outspoken Trump critic. But, you know, that is the solution. It's a solution to, you know, all these problems involving this lawless administration is simply caring about your neighbor and having the courage to do something about it. Stand up for your neighbor.
Michael Fanone, folks, I hope you appreciate why I admire this guy and have mad respect for him and his story and just listening to his experiences and part of that journey, particularly the part, because you answered the question I was going to ask before I could even ask it, and it's about how you fall into a trap that is not a good one. In other words, when you're looking at the politics and you see one side suddenly for inexplicable reasons talking about defunding the police and the police are bad, and yes, there are encounters that we all know are problematic for men of color in particular. But by and large, as a lot of folks were saying, at least in the Black community, we need the police to come when there's shit happening in the neighborhood. We want y'all to show up. So there was just this whole approach to sort of demonize, and then the other party sort of taking advantage of that and playing on those sympathies and the anger and the frustration that was beginning to brew within the police department because they felt that they were exposed unfairly and they felt they weren't being protected. And they felt that people were taking incidences and throwing them out and projecting the bad behavior of one cop on every cop. And so you sort of showed that arc there of that journey. And then on the other side of it, realizing, hey, these guys aren't about us too, because they called them to the hill to attack us. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting situation guys like yourself find yourself in, and how you now navigate in that space is an important journey and an important story for the country, I think. And so I appreciate your sharing a lot of it. You're doing your Substack. You have in your book, which again, I would recommend people, if you want to get a sense of Michael's journey here, Hold the Line, The Insurrection, and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul. Get a copy of it because it gives you some insights. As Michael said, hey, you know, I got a sheet too. I wasn't that cop who was like, yes, sir, at every turn. It was like, nah, I'm not doing that. But then there came that moment on January 6th in which a lot of things came home for you. And I appreciate you sharing that story, man. I really do.
Well, thank you for giving me a place to share it.
Hey, man, you're just good people, and I think people need to know that. I think they do, and I've heard people, you know, say good things about you, and they're curious about you because you know you've got others who've been much more profile and out there for sure. So there's an earnest and honest curiosity about you, and I think people will. Appreciate that and appreciate our conversation today and get them to know a little bit more about Michael Fanone.
If you want to read a good profile piece, Alex Morris wrote an article, I think it was like a year or two ago in Rolling Stone, and mm-hmm. it's called Michael Fanone Is Not Your Fucking Hero.
Yeah. And
I think that captured, that definitely captured me about as you know,
as poignantly as possible. So,
well, I'm glad I forgot about that one. You're absolutely right. It's a great piece. And the headline sort of tells you everything you need to know right there. So
funny story too, Michael, if we got time.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there and I finished the article with Alex and she's saying, and she's the best. She is an incredible, incredible person. But she was like, hey, so what do you want to do for the photo? And I was like, well, I'll tell you what I don't do. I'm not going to the Capitol. I'm not putting on a fucking uniform. I'm not, you know, like staring off distantly into with like an American flag behind me and all this other shit. And she's like, well, okay, so what do you want to do? And I was like, I tell you what, I want to bring my dog, a cooler of beer, and a lawn chair, and I want to sit on the west front of the Capitol and drink beer, and you guys can take pictures of it. So she said, she's like, all right, well, I'll submit that to the editors. I think his name was Patrick at the time. But she's like, I just want you to know, like, we do these things all the time with, like, you know, celebrities and musical guests and all these people, and they always have some crazy idea, and it never flies. Like, we always go for something else. She calls me back, like, 15 minutes later. She's like, they loved it. I guess we're going to do it. So I had to call Nancy Pelosi, who was a speaker at the time, right, to get permission for us.
Get permission. That's why I'm laughing. I'm like, okay, yeah. You're drinking beer on the Capitol lawn? Okay.
So she's like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, oh, ma'am, we're just going to take some pictures. And she's like, okay, nothing crazy, right? I was like, no. This is a thing for an article. She's like, of course, Michael, of course. And then later on that day, she calls me back. She's like, Michael, were you drinking beer on the west front of the Capitol? I said, oh, they were full. They were empty. She's like, you know, it's against the law to lie to the Speaker of the House.
Yes, it is. I love it. I love it. There it is. That is. It's not what you expect, folks. Trust me. That is so perfect. Perfect. And knowing Nancy, I'm sure she's like, okay, did you really? And you're like, no, man.
I think she knew right away. I think.
Oh, I know she did.
She'd gotten to know me like pretty well. You know, our first meeting, I remember one of her aides came up to me and said, you know, you said fuck 66 times in that conversation with Speaker Pelosi. They said, you know, we've seen her meet with world leaders. They say shit or damn or even hell. Like, she corrects them. But she took pity on me and my
66 times.
Hate itself. Yeah.
I love you, man. I love it. Michael Fanone, folks. He is one of a kind, and he's not just your neighborhood cop.
All right, buddy.
All right, brother. That does it for this time together, folks. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please check out Michael's Substack and at Michael Fanone on Substack. You can see him there and read more. Check out that Rolling Stone article. Trust me, it's a good one. And the book again, Hold the Line: The Insurrection and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul. Grab a copy and learn a little bit more about this man and those events. Until next time, guys, be safe, be well out there, and remember what I always tell you: stop hanging out with stupid. It's not a good look. It's not a good look. All right. Take care, everybody. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm John Fugelsang.
And I'm Professor Corey Brettschneider.
And we are here to tell you about The Oath and the Office, an essential new podcast about the extremely strange times we find ourselves in.
In the first few seconds in office, the President of the United States is required to take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And we're going to hold him to that pledge, despite the fact that he has threatened democracy and even the law itself.
It's all about hope for what democracy should look like and getting real about what our democracy does look like from an esteemed constitutional scholar and a deeply unqualified comedian.
Subscribe to The Oath in the Office wherever you get your podcasts.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.